I am so glad you could join us. I'm your host, Mo Gaudat. This podcast is nothing more than a conversation between two good friends sharing inspiring life stories and perhaps some nuggets of wisdom along the way. This is your invitation to slow down with us. Welcome to Slow Mo. Welcome back to the rest of my conversation with Jason Silva. Last episode, we discussed boredom and awe, new experiences and cannabis, how to find flow, and how to escape from flow so that when you truly see the world, you see it for what it is, not what you assume it is. Today's conversation is going to become even more interesting. Jason Silva is a futurist, a world-renowned TV personality, an internet influencer, a filmmaker, and a keynote speaker. He covers topics that vary from the future of artificial intelligence all the way to the tiniest details of who we are inside. I am a huge fan of Jason's work. I think he's truly an artist of knowledge. I personally became a dedicated fan of Jason's work when he hosted 5 seasons of the Emmy-nominated global hit TV series, Brain Games. This was recommended to me by my beloved son, and so it has a big place in my heart. It was broadcast on National Geographic in 171 countries. Jason then went on to create inspirational videos, and his inspirational series, Shots of Awe, received more than 100 million views across the internet. In that series, Jason explores topics such as technology, creativity, the future, the science of awe, disruptive innovation, relationships, and mental health. Most recently, Jason hosted the global mini-series Origins, The Journey of Humankind on the National Geographic Channel. Sit back and enjoy as we jump into topics as varied as Jason's mind. I want to ask you something, because the way you speak about it can't but get me to think that word reality is becoming so tricky. Because you say, I'm here in the world, I'm looking at it, but I'm judging it with my thoughts in a certain way. If I'm on cannabis, then I may be cutting off my links to the past and the future, and so accordingly, I can see it in a slightly different way. If I sort of masked your eyes at the time, then you would experience it in a third way. And it becomes really enriching, but also confusing, because if I don't know what's real, because real is entirely about my experience of it, how can I know anything?
Yeah, well, this is where, if you think of in the U.S., we talk about the separation of church and state.
Big topic. Okay. Go on.
Yeah, and I believe in the separation of church and state. I absolutely do. And another way of saying that is the separation between subject and object. Church is subjective and state is objective. Journalism and poetry. Because truth, or the Greeks talked about Chronos and Kairos, two ways of experiencing reality. So Chronos is like state, right? So Chronos is objective reality or objective time, time by the clock, consensus reality, mechanized cognition, the agreed upon consensus required to agree that we're doing the podcast at this date and at this time. You know, the consensus reality that is required to book a flight that takes off on a certain day. The consensus reality that is required for Airbnb for you to book a place and for the person to reply. So that's state. That's the objective reality. That's at least the consensus reality, the consensus construct that we agree upon. And I think that's absolutely vital for the functioning of a society that includes multiple members. Okay. In that sense, that version of truth is not negotiable. You know, that's why people say those quotes where it's like, you're entitled to your own opinions, but not to your own facts. You know, that version of truth. But then church and state, church is more like poetic truth or the truth of your own experience, or the truth of your inner landscape, what things felt like to you. And that's also true as long as you don't do like reality bleed-through effect, because then you're schizophrenic, right? So your church truth, your subjective truth, your poetic truth is true for you, but should never be a truth that you force upon others, because then you're a cult leader or a religious nut. And by the way, the problems that we're running into today is that people are crossing those streams. You know, in the Ghostbusters, they always say, don't cross the streams. People who separate church and state, objective, subjective, empirical, and poetic, we wouldn't have half of the problems that we have today. People were just comfortable with the side-by-sideness of those truths, consensus and individual truth. Then we'd be fine. A great quote by Alain de Botton is, you know Alain de Botton out of the UK?
I interviewed him a couple of weeks ago. Wonderful conversation. Yeah.
You should watch my podcast with him. He's a wonderful guy. So,
absolutely.
He said, while a journalist, no doubt, may be more accurate in describing the details of an event than a poet. No debate there. You know, a journalist is more accurate. There was an explosion. This many people died. The bomb was made of these materials. The journalist is more accurate in describing the details of an event than a poet. However, a poet may nevertheless reveal truths of a deeper sort beyond the literal grid. Now, we have to be careful when we say truth of a deeper sort, because I don't want people to say, well, what's truth then? Well, there's a truth beyond the literal grid that's not the same as consensus truth. It's not the same as objective truth. It's not even the same as scientific truth. But that truth of a deeper sort, that truth beyond the literal grid, is the truth of the human condition from the inside, right? It's the truth of what it feels like to fall in love. It's the truth of what it feels like when you listen to a song that gives you the goosebumps. It's the truth of what a film does to you. Objectively, a film is a fiction. The actors are reciting lines written by someone else. It's a construct. It's not even a moving image. It's 24 still frames per second. That's truth. On the other hand, beyond the literal grid, the truth of cinema occurs outside of time. It's multidimensional. It mirrors your archetypal inner life. It can speak to your psyche. It can transform you from within. Both of those things are true, as long as you keep them separate. And that is how I would answer that question. You know, perhaps Ursula Le Guin's quote, sum it up. Science describes accurately from the outside. Poetry describes accurately from the inside. Science explicates, poetry implicates.
Which is so beautiful. You think of The Great Gatsby, the first time I watched it, I was like, oh, that's an obsessive, egocentric bully. That was me watching it from the masculine brain. The second time I watched it from the feminine brain, as I worked on my feminine side, I was like, oh my God, that's the most beautiful love story ever. And neither of them actually tell the events of the movie. Neither of those perceptions is telling what happened on minute one and minute two. It's a very different truth, and both were true to me at the time. And I think that's the idea. I'm actually asking, because I think you can help me here, the idea of not constantly trying to find one truth is really where we evolve as beings.
Well, I would say not trying to find one truth for all situations, but certainly to have some kind of taxonomy or some category of truth that is like the ones we abide by in a society that requires multiple members to function. I do think we have to agree when it's...
Yeah, forget state. State is the boring part. Yes. We're going to all comply, right? But then I look at you and I find sort of a truth junkie in a way, because you're constantly jumping into experiences that are true, right? They're very varied. They're very different. That your own exact perception of Amsterdam this August can be very different than last August. But each of them is interestingly true in that it's an experience that you're feeling fully and engaging in fully as an individual right now.
And in order to steward those kinds of experiences, there has to be an appreciation for the fact that consciousness, this is the ideas of David Lenson. He's a comparative literature professor who wrote a book about the phenomenology of altered states. He says that consciousness is a collaboration between subject and object. And so he draws this equation, person multiplied by place multiplied by time. which reveals a garden of forked paths of possible consciousnesses. So people like you and me who are nomadic, we're interested in the calibration or the careful DJing of this experience. It's like, where's Jason going to go on this date, on this, and what place? And those three elements are going to come together, just like assembling a scene in a movie. Right? What's the location? Who are the actors? What's the plot? You play with those elements and you transform the fundamental reality of the film. So our lived experience is more like a film than like any kind of objective truth.
Oh, man. Yeah. Man, you drop those words in. No. No, I'm an engineer, Jason. My life is not a film. One of the coolest things about you is I actually really don't know what to expect next. So I'm actually not going to ask you a question. Talk about another topic. What else do you want to talk about?
Talk about another topic. Okay, well, so you spoke of The Great Gatsby before, which reminded me of a line in that book, Stephanie F. Scott Fitzgerald, when describing what Dutch sailors must have encountered when they discovered the New World. So try to imagine you're a European settler, early European settler, morals of European colonization aside, and you're on this boat and you arrive at a new continent. Subjectively, for them, arriving at a new continent would be akin to us arriving in a new planet, just in terms of the ontological awakening and the forceful reckoning with a whole new world beyond your maps, right? Like, I mean, it really was a new world,
yeah,
experience,
yeah,
for these people.
Yeah,
I envy what they subjectively might have experienced, especially if they were poetically inclined. So F. Scott Fitzgerald writes that in this moment, you know, as they were beholding a fresh green breast of a new world, he says, man must have held his breath in the presence of this new continent, compelled into an aesthetic contemplation he neither understood nor desired, face to face for the last time in history with something commensurate to his capacity for wonder. So to be face to face with something commensurate to your capacity for wonder, because I think my capacity for wonder is infinite, but the more you familiarize yourself with the world, the less what you encounter is commensurate to your capacity for wonder. You're more and more disenchanted or let down because,
yeah,
things don't meet your the aspirations. And it speaks to me because that is like a go-to idea for me when I have a perfectly calibrated experience of awe. I am compelled into an aesthetic contemplation face-to-face with something could measure it to my capacity. Yes, yes, like William Blake, I see the world in a grain of sand, heaven in a wildflower, infinity in the palm of my hand, eternity in an hour. So I'm very good at creating that for myself. I've made my entire lifestyle, you know, a series of cycles of going there. And then I come out of that with all this content, which are basically, my videos are basically trip reports, right? Like they are my accounts of like what I've just been grappling with.
Yeah.
But in spite of this abundance, in spite of the calibration that I've sort of mastered, there is still a fear that I'll never be as inspired again when the world does not cooperate, because you can't help but be an optimist as well. Like when you have like regular experiences of awe, like you have regular encounters with the best of humanity, whether you're marveling at technology, our problem-solving capacity, the wonders of the universe, you're optimistic. But when the world doesn't mirror that optimism, and COVID is the elephant in the room, the world on its knees, the powerful nations, you know, human beings as with our towering majesty,
yeah,
our technological prowess and our satellites in space and our rockets that land themselves and the internet that collapses distance and geography and our marvelous understanding of genetics and the software of life, like all of this, right? That makes me think, yeah, we're on our way to the singularity and we're on our knees. We're like the world on its knees, like people wearing masks, afraid of being near each other for an invisible thing we can't fully figure out. It's been so depressing and so just a constant interruption, like a splinter in my mind, deflating my aspirations for awe and transcendence that before that I had some cruise control.
But isn't that in itself awe? Isn't that in itself awe? I mean, is the shock of like, wow, that is so different than what I expected life to be? Or does it have to always be positive?
Well, I mean, no, you're right. Some people would say that awe can be terrifying, but that's not kind of awe that I play with. So I think for me, rather than awe, it's just deflating. It's been an encounter with mediocrity and fear and darkness, like seeing like the fragility of the systems that hold us together.
Oh, yeah.
Sort of seeing the brokenness and just the frailty. Just the concept of a mind virus as well, right? The mind virus of fear. Stephen Kotler actually posted this clip on Instagram. He was saying that the amygdala in the brain evolved in a world where the danger was the tiger in a bush variety. But that today we live in a world where danger is more like probabilistic. What are the odds that a terrorist hits us? You know, what are the odds that a pandemic collapses society? What are the odds that COVID is less dangerous or more dangerous than we think? You know, what are the odds that these vaccine conspiracies that some of these nutbags on the internet are talking about? You know, so the problem is that probabilistic dangers are never resolved.
Yeah. Right?
The tiger in the bush is you check if it's a bush or a tiger, you run away, you're good. So COVID is the most pervasive and ever-present probabilistic danger. We're suffocating it like a heat wave, and it's unresolvable.
It lingers, yeah.
So the amygdalas of the entire planet are activated, in my view. And so even politicians, government officials, I mean, what's going on in Australia, dude, like the police state where people can't leave their house for more than an hour a day. I mean, it's just like, it's leading to a level of response that I don't think, look, I'm not a scientist, not a doctor, but the level of response doesn't seem congruent with the level of threat.
Oh, totally
not. But the problem with the threat is that it's probabilistic. So because it's probabilistic, we're erring on the side of worst case scenario because that's what the amygdala gets wired for. You know? So what happens is it's basically a panic attack, right?
Exactly. A planetary panic attack.
Correct. And then this is the dark side of social media, right? Because social media is wired to our collective nervous system.
Yeah.
And so the collective nervous system of humanity is tethered together.
Yeah.
And it's a feedback loop, right? Because social media reflects our nervous system and our nervous system reflects social media. It's like we're stuck in this feedback loop, unintended one. And I don't really see a way out until the vaccines work so well that the media machine can no longer keep telling crazy stories. And perhaps that enough time has passed that the fear just subsides and people stop ignoring. I don't know, something like that. But in the meantime, it's a fucked up time.
It really is.
Because you know where I want to live. You know this place I like to go to. And that's how I serve. That's how I make the content. That's how I make awe go viral, the way you make happiness go viral. To that degree, I feel been a real challenge for me.
You know, so I fully understand. I mean, I don't think it's not been a challenge for anyone. Even as I speak publicly about how to handle this, the fact that I speak about it publicly is because it's a challenge. I think the thing that really served me, though, is that you're an experience junkie, you're an awe junkie. I'm a gamer. And gamers, we take life very differently. It's like when life is unpredictable, what you do is you actually focus more on the present moment. You don't know which other three enemies are going to attack around the corner, right? And you don't know which weapons you'll find there, and right? It's a game. And so what you do is you tell yourself, okay, so how do I make the best out of this current moment? There are two enemies attacking me, one from the left, one from the right. What do I do now? And I think by focusing deeply on that experience, I don't know, I something's wrong with me, but I find fun in this. I find fun in the challenge of like situations where I obviously have very little to do to influence the rest of the world. All I can influence is my very little world, which is despite the baseline of what the rest of the world is.
Yeah. It's interesting. I think that normally my relationship with the present, my intentional entering into like the deep now and deep play, usually is a negotiation with my amygdala.
Exactly.
There's a part of me that says, okay, Jason, for the next 5 to 6 hours, you are safe. And for the next, no matter what's going on in the world,
so
the next five
cool.
to 6 hours,
yeah.
You can turn your phone on. When you come back 6 hours from now, global banks won't have collapsed. Your credit card will still work. You'll still be able to go get dinner. Civil unrest won't make it dangerous for you to find a place to sleep tonight. The apartment you rented is waiting for you. Because when you do go into deep now, there's nothing worse than coming out of deep now back into the world in which you're pre-mapping your next steps and then having to like deal with hiccups. And you come out of the deep now and you don't have a place to sleep tonight and you're tired and you want to just take a quiet bath and relish the day you had. But it's like, oh man, I don't have a place to stay, or the banks collapse, or COVID just announced a new lockdown. So it's like the situation now is so fluid that even taking 5 or 6 hours off, oh my God, what am I going to come back to?
Yeah. Is that related to flow states as you described them earlier? Is that what we struggle with, to find that full presence into experiences? What happens chemically when we go through those experiences?
Well, I think that I would say that being in awe, I'm not sure if it's exactly the same neurochemistry, but it definitely plays in a similar place. Like clearly when I'm in awe, I'm in a kind of flow state. Now, some people get into flow through extreme sports. Some people get it through musical artistry, you know, all these ways. Mine is this interesting dance between sort of perceptual, sort of sensuous state of intensity. I like to have novelty. I like to have some motion. And then immediately the feedback loop of like responding to that with the verbosity of my videos, which themselves are a flow state, right? The flow that I go with my word jazz is also a thing. And so, yeah, I mean, if you've read the book Stealing Fire, there's a chapter.
Absolutely.
Stephen Kotler and Jamie wrote about me. They call me the ambassador of ecstasis.
Yeah.
And they sort of told my story and how the discovery of flow, and then within that space, my relationship with awe has been an interesting, I guess, antidote or medicine. Again, these proclivities for worry and anxiety that I also have. I grew up in Venezuela, and I grew up very privileged in Venezuela, but also because of that, you are a target for crime. Pretty much everyone in my family was assaulted at gunpoint at one point or another. My dad was kidnapped once, multiple guys with guns, driven around for several hours in the city. They said they were going to kill him. He jumped out of a moving vehicle.
Wow.
So when that safe space of your childhood was regularly violated, even just by the awareness, oh my God, they broke into your uncle's house, or oh my God, they broke the window, or oh my God, they broke the, you know, you, it makes it very hard to relax or to put aside your vigilance. And then that gets imprinted in your nervous system and it can make you a really wound up guy. And the discovery of flow and the artistry, my relationship with making videos, making content, just going into that creative space was a wonderful refuge and an antidote. Again, there was always a relationship and permission and negotiation with my amygdala. Like, okay, I'm safe. I'm good. This ticks my boxes. I can put my amygdala aside and be in this moment. But again, once that negotiation was done, going into that space allowed me to experience life free of the constraints of a nervous system that was wired for hypervigilance.
What a brilliant path through life, my friend. You're so something else. Jason, I have one more question, but before I do, I will just have to say everyone listening to you is so privileged today. This is such an incredible conversation. And I remind people before my last question every time that my mission is 1 billion happy people. And so if you're as inspired as I am by this incredible conversation with Jason, then you know in your heart that someone else can be inspired. So please spread the message. Take what Jason told you. Tell others. Rate the podcast positively so that others know that there is a good value in it for them. Tell people about it on social media. I will never reach 1 billion happy. I can only reach 1 billion happy if each of you engages. So please, please, please spread the word. Jason, this is a sensitive question. And I warn you before I say this, 75% of my audience are women. Okay. So they're going to be upset if you say the wrong answer. And we don't care if they get upset, if it's what you feel, it's your reality, right? So when it comes to love and relationships, there is that element of stability, which is almost the opposite of awe, right? It's almost the opposite of, I want to experience new experiences. I want to be out there. I want to find moments that are not like the moment of yesterday. Yet, innate in us humans, we want that stability. By the way, men or women. So there is always a moment in one's life where we feel like, yeah, like I mentioned about my coffee machine, we all want that. We all want that intimacy of there is someone familiar, someone connected, someone deeply, deeply associated with me. But then that negotiates with the idea of, oh, there is another experience right over there, but I'm off limits for now. I can't take that other experience. How do you balance those?
First of all, I am a huge romantic. and I think there is so much poetry.
Beauty in romance, yeah.
Beauty in romance. And I have not become cynical. There's the neurochemistry of romantic love and how yeah. you know, they've done scans on people's brains, like falling in love or falling in lust through the early honeymoon stages, like doing lots of cocaine and this and that. I'm like, it doesn't matter. That's like going back to the church and state. I'm like, fine. Like the state definition is, yeah, it's dopamine and da-da-da-da. But the church definition, you know, is that love is like encountering the divine. Like that is church. The best definition, and Ernest Becker wrote a book called Denial of Death, and he was a psychoanalytical writer, Pulitzer Prize winning book in 1974. And he says that the reality of the human condition, and by this he means our finitude and our mortality, is so unbearable to a creature that can ponder the infinite, right? So with our minds, we can ponder the infinite, but we're housed in heart pumping, breath gasping, and decaying bodies. And the duality of that, that we are simultaneously gods and worms, puts us in quite a predicament. And he says the religious impulse is born from this, right? So we want to merge with something that helps us overcome our animality. And it can be God, it can be creativity and artistry, right? The things we make, the cathedrals we built, the poetry we write, or it can be romantic love. So he calls romantic love the romantic solution to the problem of death. And I get it. Like some people might say, well, that's just you're idealizing a person and you're creating an impossible standard for a human being and your gods will eventually reveal their clay feet and so on and so forth. And that's a fair argument, but it matters not to me. I know that when I meet somebody who lights me up, when they have that faraway look in their eye, when they smile in just the right way, when there's a tenderness that reveals an inner world that I want to know about more, when I fall deeply in love with somebody, I believe it transports us to a realm together outside of time.
Totally.
Becker calls it a cosmology of two shaped like a heart. So what is that? That's an intersubjective world. So my subjectivity and her subjectivity together becomes a place where it's our world. Like we create a world together. And I don't know if you ever saw the film Vanilla Sky, came out in 2001.
Yeah.
So if you remember the end of that film, you know, he's talking about his romantic love story with the Penelope Cruz character and how he basically created a waking dream with her. And that waking dream was shaped by these early templates or impressions when you're a child and you watch your first love story, an album cover that moved you, you know, a movie you watched late at night that showed you what love is like. So we have these pop culture imprints and templates, and then we spend our lives like emulating those in our romantic lives. So we're imitating the movies we watched and the songs we listened to. You know, my uncle calls it, oh yeah, the girl from all those songs. And cynics will say that this is an example of like media manipulation programming you to create impossible standards, da da da. But like optimists and romantics like me will say, no, this is what's beautiful. It's like you hear a song you love and then you want to go sing that song with that girl you meet. You know, like I want to actively create my romantic movie with my lover. And is it hard to sustain? Sure, but all the good things are. Does it require sort of deliberate, intentional work to a certain degree? Yeah, sure. But so does like entering states of awe. I guess it matters not. I'm stubborn in my romanticism.
And in that case, you're saying you can have an infinite number of experiences of awe with one romantic lover?
I think that you can do things, because I think that when you get into that place with a person, it's hard to sustain because it can grow stale.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think if you both understand how hedonic adaptation works, then you can do things together. If you don't want to swap partners, you can certainly swap the backdrop and it would probably biochemically do the same thing. So for me, it's like fall in love and then travel the world. It's like, hey, my love, like I've experienced you for 3 months in San Francisco, but I want to experience you walking through Tokyo. I want to experience you naked on the beaches of Tulum. I want to experience you in Bali on the back of a motorbike at sunset. I want to experience and you listen to the Inception score while we're like driving through Iceland. And probably we'll smoke some pot in those places too. But I can create experiences that create dopamine, that create heightened qualitative intensity, that create heightened salience, and constantly imprint my nervous system again and again and again with this person. So by actively and deliberately doing that, I do think you can have that passion honeymoon everlasting. I tried to do that with my last girlfriend. We lasted for a year and a half, and then she had a different priority.
She went on for a different kind of awe. You know what, Jason? I'll tell you this. I swear from my heart, I am becoming a Jason Silva true junkie. I've seen so much of your work, but having spoken one-to-one, oh man, I wish people could experience this seriously. You are such a gem with such a varied view and perspective of life in so many ways. You're an adventurer.
Takes one to know one.
Oh, thank you. You're an adventurer of a very, very, very different kind. And I will say this has left me thinking. This has left me looking at life differently. So I will take every single one of your videos that probably will take me 600 years to watch online. And I will encourage people to do that too. And then next time I'm in Amsterdam or wherever you are, you definitely owe me a coffee.
Well, first of all, thank you for those kind words. And I appreciate what you're trying to do in the world and touching a billion people. You're one of the new billionaires, positively touch a billion lives. And yeah, it feels really beautiful to be seen by you, to be witnessed by your eyes. So thank you.
Thank you. Amazing, amazing, amazing.
And for all of you who joined us, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to follow me on social media. Search for MoGaudet, Slow-Mo, Soul for Happy, or 1 Billion Happy. I know you've got a lot going on, but remember, there is always time to slow down. Until next time, stay happy.